So for all of our callers, let me give a brief introduction of our two guest speakers today. Dr. Ruth Richards, one of our speakers today, has got her MD from Harvard and PhD from UC Berkeley. And Dr. Richards teaches at Saybrook University's Creative Studies program. And she's also written a book on everyday creativity that has achieved both scholarly and popular acclaim. And our second speaker today is Dr. Shona Moran. And Shona is calling us from Massachusetts today. And Shona has this, Dr. Moran has this BA from University of Southern California and an MBA from University of New Mexico, MED in Mind, Brain, and Behavior Plus, and then EDD in Human Development and Psychology from Harvard University. And she's got postdoctoral training at Stanford University. And Dr. Moran has is an editor of one of the books as well, and that is Ethics in Creativity. So Ruth and Shona, welcome to our call. Thank you so much for joining us today. And shall I say good morning to Ruth and good afternoon to Shona?
Yes, good morning. I'm sorry I'm coughing a little, but I'll try not to. should I just say a few introductory things?
Yes, so if you would share with us your perspective on our today's theme, that is creativity. So
okay,
if you would just expand on that for us, please.
I wanted to sneak in one thing because we're talking about different perspectives and different influences. And I know one couple that just celebrated their 68th anniversary, and they wouldn't even have met if they hadn't been in the same bookstore at the same time looking at music. And, you know, so much of life is like this. We think we control it, but there are many evolving things that happen. And emergence is a key term here. And it's very relevant to what emerges creatively in our minds, which is a big interest at the moment. But I personally wanted to acknowledge two people in my life, and one is my mother's mother, Helen, and the other is a childhood friend, Lael Leslie's mother, Edith, because without either of them, I wouldn't be here. And I was amazed to see Lael, this old friend of mine, about a year ago, and find out her mother didn't even know this, that my grandmother had gotten me interested in arts in a lovely way. So it also meant love and connection and things. But Lael's mom had given me some lessons as a preteen after this initial introduction. And she's also a very spiritual person in her 90s, Edith, and really helped me on my way. And I think that as I trace it back, my lifelong interest in studying creativity, which has broadened and broadened in meaning, started there. And so I had sent Edith a copy of that book you just mentioned, Everyday Creativity and New Views of Human Nature. And I'm going to go visit her this Thanksgiving. But I wanted to acknowledge the many people in all of our lives where we don't even know they're giving us new perspectives, or we forgot, or something, because life happens like that. I think you're wanting me to define creativity, so let me do that. When my colleagues at Saybrook University or at Harvard Medical School, where we originally developed a scale called the Lifetime Creativity Scale, and even got written up by Daniel Goleman in the New York Times, because it was different. A lot of people had been looking at creativity, as I used to do, as about painting a picture or doing a scientific experiment, and that was it. And those were the creative people, not us. Think about that. So we decided that's wrong. We're all the creative people. And it's not about doing art and science, which are great, but doing everything. It's not just what we do. It's how we do it, how we live. So it becomes about the creative process and the creative person, as well as the creative, there are four P's, product. That's the third P. And the fourth P is the environment, the press of the environment. So it's product, process, person, press. Anyway, our scales, which were not, you know, little check-off something scales, based on interviews of people on their real-life activities at work, at leisure. They were homemakers. They were redesigning their houses. They were, you know, doing a new advertising campaign, planning a benefit. One guy was helping his disabled child by redesigning a wheelchair, a mechanic who created his own tools. I mean, these are extraordinarily creative people. So we were looking for ways to assess this, because once you have a scale, people take you seriously. It's interesting. Before that, someone's idea. Okay, now we have a scale. And we did some research I can mention later. But here we have the lifetime creativity scales, and what we were looking at was everyday creativity in real life, at work, at leisure, at home, and based only on originality. So is it new, different, and meaningfulness? You know, was it intentional, not random or accidental? Not is it useful, that gets society involved and other things. So I think I've said enough. But,
sure. Thank you so much.
I'll add one thing. Go. Started this out working in education and training to be a teacher, and the goal of some people in schools of education is to help kids get 100% on somebody else's test. So we were saying, wait a minute, what about asking your own questions? Right? Or wait a minute, what about taking some risks? We don't always have to get 100. We want to try things out. And so these are creative attitudes which also challenge the status quo and don't always make the highly creative person the most popular. So I'll stop.
Thank you so much. I love the four P's, and I'm hoping to expand a bit more on that. Mm-hmm. Shauna, would you also share your perspective on creativity and what it means to you and what you have done about it?
First, I would like to thank you, Devin, and Bella, and Service Space, Ruth, and all the callers for creating this awakening call, because I think it's a great opportunity of the way I think about, it's an example of the way I think about creativity, as in we're all creating some meaning together, and I hope some ripples of both understandings and actions beyond this call to have positive effects on each other's thinking that we can take, again, as a further ripple effect into our lives with further conversations around creativity, the ethics of creativity, responsible creativity, and what I like to think of also as creative responsibility, which is really what this book, The Ethics of Creativity, published by Paul Gregg Macmillan, is about, to get people talking about how to more intentionally engage the power of creativity to influence kind of the momentum in ourselves and our lives and our communities. So creativity is producing new and useful ideas and products and organizations. It also launches into existing systems of relationships, such as, again, an organization or a field of knowledge or society, and it changes some of those relationships. And those changes can have far-reaching effects as people pick up and make use of an idea or product. As you were saying earlier, Devin, we contribute to each other's thinking far more than we probably realize, and often we don't have a feedback loop to see the consequences of the seeds that we've planted in each other and that we've allowed others to plant in ourselves, and I think that's really the foundation of creativity. I also think of creativity not so much as breaking from the past. Sometimes there's this notion of creativity is obliterating something in the past, and I tend to think of it as one of the dynamics of culture to have momentum into the future. So it shifts meanings, and meanings can be infinitely malleable. And so at the small scale, you know, when we're on the ground in our lives engaging, creativity is the practice of recognizing kind of a penumbra or a kind of a periphery of life in this, and by recognize, I mean not only realizing that it's there, that there's more than the first right answer, or there's more than what everybody currently agrees on. There's this realm of possibility, but also recognizing, as in the sense of thinking about things differently, because we have this peripheral vision, this fuzzy area about around what we normally focus on, that everyone can do and everyone does do. And as we make it a practice and a habit and come to love this reframing of what is into what could be, we create these ripple effects that have just amazing possibilities to help increase the capacity of humanity at its broadest.
See, I love that. I love that realm of possibility and ripple effect. In service space, Shauna and Ruth, we talk about the ripple effect, like you do one small positive action and the chain reaction of that in small circles, and they actually add so much impact to quality of life. And when we are saying quality of life, we are talking about quality of life of individuals that are trying to do something really meaningful in day-to-day life. And it's such a nice paradigm to look at that. And then it reminded me of one comment that you had, Ruth, when we talked about it a little bit before, and that is harmony of the whole, and meaning that sometimes we try to be in control, and a zeal for just seizing the control can actually be throttling the creativity. Mm. And so my next question that I'm thinking about here is, what do you think are ways to unlock the creativity? And if you would maybe give us a few examples, that'll be good as well. And I would love to hear on this from both of you. So if I may ask you, Ruth, first on that. Like,
yeah, sure. I think sometimes it's just about getting out of our own way. And by that, I mean getting our kind of image of ourselves and our worry that we're going to not have a good enough idea and all that stuff out of the way to just be present, as Thich Nhat Hanh was saying. I mean, that sounds easy, right? But being open to new ideas, well, I'll give you a little test, okay? Because there's some research here, and it's revealing of what can be happening in our brains. And I don't mean to say the mind is only the brain, but anyway, in our brains, when we're being creative, okay? So if you're given three words and the idea is to find a fourth word that links in any way to the other three, and there can be more than one answer, but one example would be 16, sugar, and heart. And if, I don't know if people can speak up here, but anyone who just has a thought of some word that links.
16, sugar, and heart. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
That just links in any way. And I will give a, actually, this could be an answer, but no.
So can I give an answer? So any fourth word that links in with those three?
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking of sweet 16. Well, this is more than one word.
Yeah,
but I just have the image
no,
of a sweet tea party.
And we don't want to get hung up on how many words, right?
Okay.
No, that's perfectly wonderful. Sweet 16, sugar is sweet, and sweetheart. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm less interested in your answer as how you found it.
Mm.
That
oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we've gone from product to creative process.
Mm. Okay.
Do you have a sense, like, did you suddenly think, sweet, or did you kind of reason, well, let's see, 16, 17? or some mixture, or, you know, do you have some sense of what happened there? Probably very quickly.
Yeah, well, I'm a very, I like, what's the word? I think better in terms of images. So as soon as you said sugar, I don't know, I saw those three words, and it was like in a matter of seconds, this image popped in my head of a 16-year-old girl with a little crown and blowing out candles and a cake that's shaped like a heart. And
yay!
A really sugary cake.
Okay. I love that. All right. There are some folks, actually, quite a few years ago, the late Colin Martindale started doing some creativity research on this kind of thing, and some other people have more recently, using things like EEGs and fMRIs. So you would not have just been asked this. You would have been hooked up to equipment first or put in a huge machine before you even got the question. But this is clever research because it turns out that we will use different strategies, some of us different ones at different times, right? So we might suddenly get an answer to something like this. Again, it's 16 sugar and heart and sweets one associate. We might get that by insight. Boom, right? There it is. Ta-da. Maybe with a picture and a girl in a beautiful dress. Or we might get it analytically by saying, okay, let's see, sweet, sour, you know, or some mixture. But in this research, this is going to be too long a story, but in this research, they took people after and kind of sorted them by what their strategy was at that moment for that question, which was like the one I just gave you. And
all right,
a series of questions. And so they took the insight people and I said, now, what's going on in those brains? And actually, what's going on in those brains from my point of view, these are my words, is an altered state of consciousness. That when we're open to inspiration, we are not in ordinary waking mind or beta waves. We're more into like theta waves, like when we're meditating. It's more right-sided. This is now Collins' research. And that's just what you were saying, Bela. I think that was Bela. And it may be more visual. It may be more symbolic. There may be many things coming at once. That's the experience. It's more associative. Mm. But the neurology is actually showing a different kind of brain function. And the frontal part that we are glad are still growing when young people are in their 20s, you know. and that meditation can increase, by the way, the executive functions. That those parts are relatively silent when we're receiving creative inspiration. So that this is more, I cannot emphasize this enough, this is a moment for humility. It's a moment for openness. It's a moment to stretch ourselves beyond all these preconditioned ideas and things we were talking about at the beginning to what could be. As well as what could be in the future. And let me just say the word emergence again, right? What may emerge we never even thought about, where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And what's so cool is neurology is now adding here. Some people call it neurophenomenology. We can link our subjective experience to some of these scientific readings. And one of the most promising things to me is evidence from this kind of study that some people, and I bet all you guys on the call can do this, can turn on that brain state in advance. Right? Now we're going to do the word thing, and you kind of turn it on. I said this to one person over Skype, and he kind of looked up in the air, and I said, that looks good. You know, we get this thing that creativity is about, oh, we're going to learn this new skill, and there's plenty to be said for learning it, or do brainstorming, that's good, but maybe there's more to it that is more about how we think in general and even who we are, and I can come back later to who we are. I'll be quiet now.
Sure. That's a great insight right there, that there is a biology and there is a the brain chemistry, and there are ways to actually tap into that, and that's very fascinating.
Yeah.
So if I may go to you, Shauna, with the same question, what do you think can help unlock creativity in ourselves?
I think it's an interesting term, unlock. And so I teach, I currently teach a seminar on creativity, collaboration, and human development. And I was in advertising for many years before I went back for my doctoral degree and was a trainer there as well. And I think collaboration, as in co-labor, is a key tool in terms of helping each other stretch, because and then in internalizing that work as well, but to remember that we're actually all creating together, and to keep that in mind, I think is helpful. And that's the first principle that I work by. The second principle I work by is to set up a focus or an attitude that we're working towards something, which is a forward-thinking attitude, not against something, reactionary. And again, this is creativity as building versus creativity as going against something, because I think there's much more power in building towards something than the energy it takes to try to resist something you don't like. And I think it's much more effective in making change in everything that I've been involved with. To the best way to get rid of something that isn't working is to replace it with something that works better. And that's kind of an epitome of a way that we can think about creativity. And again, thinking that we're part of this flow or rhythm, a cooperative momentum, that in being creative, we're in this together. So that is my basic framing of creativity. And I don't actually teach about creativity. I don't have a textbook. And I usually just use tools and focus. It's a 3-hour-long class all in one block. And so it's experiencing creativity. And usually it has to do with activities on noticing and sensitivity, where I'll take them on walks. And then I'll have them close their eyes, and I'll just ask them questions about what do you feel on your face, or what do you hear now, or some of these senses that, with our eyes open, since we're such a visually oriented society right now, that takes a little bit of time, but they start to actually feel the slight wind on their face. Or they might hear the birds first, but then they realize, or the traffic first, but then they realize the birds, or they hear somebody that just got up from the grass. So, and then I usually jolt or shift something to shock them out of their habits. And a lot of times this is asking questions where the first right answer will come out very quickly, the one that is shared. For example, I use a prompt like, I just write 1 + 1 = on the board and ask people to tell me what the answer is. And, so what is it? Pretty much people go right to 2. And I say, yes, absolutely, that's right. And what else could it be? And so after they realize that there's more than one right answer, for example, if you're a computer coder and you know a binary math system, then 1 + 1 = 0, and that's the right answer. And then people start to realize visually you can put the ones together and it becomes 11. Or you can cross the ones, and it becomes a plus sign. And all of a sudden, it's like a popcorn effect. You actually can't stop them. It's interesting to see. And then we talk about, what are all the different perspectives that you came to see this simple equation at? Or I ask the question, what one word does every teacher in America pronounce wrong?
Wow, right. I love that. Some popcorn effect. It's like suddenly the ideas are popping in your mind, right? That's what you're referring to there.
Yeah.
Very fascinating and a lot of fun here. I wish I could actually take your class, and you got me excited to do that. So it's only 3,500 miles a flight, but I will take one of those days and get in your class.
That would be wonderful.
Right. So now, one of the things that you touched upon, Ruth, is that it's about being vulnerable. Like when you are opening yourself up for creative ideas, you are making yourself susceptible in that moment, in that whatever that you have held on to as your perception or your way of looking at things, it might be shaken up. And it reminded me of Stephen Covey's words, and he said that every time that you try to understand someone else, actually, if you are genuinely trying to understand a person, then you are letting your guard down, and you need security from inside to be able to do that, because you are going to feel vulnerable. The other person might and probably will have a different perspective, and so how do you handle with that? How do you deal with that? And how do you develop that security? And I love that. And another thing that is so fascinating that I got from Ethics of Creativity, Shona, and some of her prior conversations, and is that when you have a creative idea and we are trying to implement that in a situation, then you are putting yourself in a position of a change maker. And I love the spin, and I love the paradigm that you are actually trying to create something meaningful and positive for future. So it's not like you are trying to run away from something. You are just, the mindset is to do something new. Mm-hmm. But along the way, when I have been in a position like that before myself, and I think we all are, because in this day and age, we all have ideas, and ideas have to work with people around me. And sometimes ideas can be disruptive to them in their routine. And so my next question is, how do you go about dealing with that? Like, what kind of tools would you recommend for any of our community leaders that is trying to make a change? What do you think would help while trying to navigate relationships when people have strong reactions, for example? How do you handle that?
A couple of thoughts. Oh,
go ahead.
Ruth, would you like to please go?
No, you go ahead and then, I will.
Oh, okay. A couple of thoughts that come to mind is I think, I have two thoughts. One is staying present in the here and now and not thinking that we know everything we need to know. So I'm a firm believer in listening, and you brought up Stephen Covey, think first to work first to understand and then be understood. And a lot of times with creativity, I come back to this notion of the other and not to be afraid of the other, not to walk in like I know. I actually try to set aside my knowledge, and I focus on perception, is what is going on in the situation, what is it that this other person's interests are or needs are, where are they coming from when they're resisting my new idea. There is a lot of research in the creativity literature about, you know, inertia is in a system, resistance to a new idea, because creativity, a new idea, can, even if it's an absolutely wonderful idea and a workable idea, sometimes it's just like we're afraid of what we might have to give up, and there's some uncertainty when you're transferring into a new situation with a new idea and the way the idea is going to be implemented. And so recognizing these types of inertias or resistances as you may be onto something, because there's energy there. Even anger has some energy. And in my classes, I'm up front with the students because they write case studies of the future. They usually take an innovation and think through ethical implications, you know, how of that idea as it rolls out, before it has rolled out, so they have to use their imagination some. And I tell them that there's this great word in the dictionary, collywobble, C-O-L-L-Y, wobble, and it's an actual word, I didn't make it up. That is that feeling.
Heavy wobble?
Collie, C-O-L-L-Y, wobble, W-O-B-B-L-E-S, collywobbles, you can look it up. It's that feeling in your stomach that you get when you're both excited and afraid at the same time. It's just like there's interest, but you're not quite sure what to do. And that is good information because, again, it's something you might be onto something. And so when other people have collywobbles, again, that type of, that's good information that you can
make use of, and to learn first from what other people have invested in the system as it's currently operating before trying to push anything. You know, if you're a consultant and you come into a company, it's less likely to work changing the company if you just come in with a notebook program that says this is what you got to do, versus understanding how the company already works, or the school works, or each class I teach is different because the participants, the students, are different. So I think I would start with listening and allowing that everybody has a role, and seeing that as a positive thing, that creativity comes from the cooperation of many minds working together, not a lone genius.
Sure. Yeah, and you touched on understanding the people first, and empathy is so important, and it's something that we actually emphasize a lot in our service-based core values too, like empathy and giving space to people, like we call it holding the space, mm-hmm. where they actually feel the comfort level to open up and share. And so how else, Ruth, you wanted to add to that as well, right?
Sure. We actually talk about empathy as a form of creativity. It's relational. You know, it's original. It's evolving. It is, if people are really relating to each other, they're authentic, they're in the moment, and they are changing, right? Like you say something, and I change. My brain changes, my memories. So there's no reason to stop defining creativity with about things we do. It can also be how we relate to each other, of course, you know, as Shauna's saying, you know, we're going to collaborate and we're going to co-create. I wanted to mention two things. One is this amazing book, because Shauna gets a lot of credit and her co-editors for getting it out there, along with a visionary publisher. The Ethics of Creativity, you will not find dozens of books like that. And why is this, you know? I was very honored to be asked to write a chapter, and I'd like to say more about why creativity can help us become better people, which is what I wrote about. But just the fact of this book tells us a lot, because here we have ethics, and some people say, ooh, ethics, morals, this is going to be painful, right? And you know, not a horrible thing. And I don't know if I have time to tell the story I told you, Devin, of the most venerable Tikton too, but very briefly, this amazing Zen master in Vietnam I was privileged to meet. And I asked him through my translator this kind of annoying question about why should we want to help everyone? Why can't we just take care of ourselves? And I didn't really mean it, but he smiled, and this lovely senior monk, sage, and much more, in his saffron robes, just smiled. And the room
wow.
got brighter, and the golden light was everywhere, and my translator literally was crying, and it was so lovely.
Wow.
In that moment, wow. there was no question why. And this was not some horrible duty to serve others. It wasn't even something where you think about, now I'm going to serve others. It was just the way. So that's the, I guess, the spiritual answer here.
Sure.
Could I follow up on something that Ruth said, please? Is that possible?
Yes. Correctly.
When she brought up the book, The Ethics of Creativity, and the notion that ethics has kind of a bad reputation, I think that is an important point. And there is a professor from the University of Toronto that gave this a wonderful lecture, and there's a podcast of it through Big Ideas, which is the TED Talk of Canada, basically, a lot of times ethics, I think of ethics in terms of responsibility, which is response. The ability to respond and influence a situation, another's thinking
Correct.
Or feelings or well-being. And she talked about the difference. It's important to make a difference between responsibility and accountability, because in a lot of ways, ethics and even responsibility has been co-opted by this accountability word, which comes from accounting, which is to settle the books and to allocate costs. placing blame, fault, and liability, they think has made ethics into a negative word, where ethics is our ability to make good. And I think that's a really important point that Ruth was making. And with this book, it took a long time for creativity and ethics to come together, because they were always thought about in very different ways and very different fields. And that is the hope, that this book will create a conversation about how much mindful good creativity can do.
All right. And yeah. How insightful and how well said. Ruth, you coined the term co-create, and I just smile, because with Awakening Calls, we also say that we are co-creating the call with our callers. We are holding the space, and we are sharing the journey together. And Bela actually reminded me that we have reached our 30-35 minute mark. I have more questions to ask and all, but Bela, would you like to open up the queue and get our callers involved also at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the queue is ready to accept questions. So if you have a question, please just press *6 so that I can unmute you and you could join the conversation. And while we're waiting for people to join the queue, Devin, do you want to continue with your question?
Yes. So thank you, Bela. So all of our callers, you are welcome to chime in, and we would love to get your questions and thoughts. You can also email us questions by sending your email at ask@servicespace.org. It's ask@servicespace.org. And so, Ruth and Shona, this is very insightful, and I wanted to be sure that I get this from you today. Well, we are trying to squeeze in a lot of things in this call, and that is this whole journey of creativity, understanding it, explaining it, writing about it, teaching about it, doing work on it with other people, how has that made impact on you personally?
Mm-hmm.
Ruth, if I may ask you to go first, and then would love to hear on that from Shona as well.
Okay. But I'm going to go back to what Shona said, too, that this is about being out there in the world, working with others, hearing them, and living with that collie wobble, if I have that right. That is really an opportunity. So I would say several things have changed. And one is I started out doing this in education, but I've worked with creativity in clinical settings and social action and in spiritual development. And I've just seen it get broader and broader. But one thing I want to say here is it really seems to bring forward a different worldview, which I think probably to people on this call is, not so strange, but it is to some reductionist kind of materialistic scientist.
Okay.
Which is that we are in a cosmos of awe and mystery, and more than just what we see, right? And that when we're being creative, we're aware of that, and we're open to knowing more than we know now, which is automatically scary. So the collie wobble, I'm saying collie wobble's a good sign. So suddenly, if we're truly committed to this, we are more committed, going back to 4 P's, to process than to product, and that's for us too. We're more committed to ourselves being changing in connection, growing, than to some fixed image of self, which is the ego thing that can get in the way. And so if you really are prioritizing this willingness, then that doesn't mean it wouldn't still be scary at times, but that's a good sign. Like, this is good. Ooh, there's something there, right? We want to pursue this. And we're going to learn something, but we don't know what. Okay, that's a different way of being. Of course, some teachers, bosses, and I must say even some parents at times don't always want to hear that, because they want to do what they can. But
all right,
it's a different way of living. And it's a process way. And the worldview, again, the word humility makes sense because we're saying things emerge. We don't always know what's going to happen. In fact, we've done some horrible things as a species to other species because we didn't think enough about the bigger picture. But if we're really, but we also may have some unusual possibilities for human development, for consciousness, that we also can't quite grasp yet, but that can be there if we're willing to take the risk to go beyond what we think we are and are doing now. So going back to 1 plus 1 equals whatever, 1 plus 1 can also equal 1, right, in the phase 2. But once you start asking those questions and saying, okay, that's one answer, but what are some others? I mean, that really pushes the boundaries. You say, how can we enhance our creativity? Just ask 3 questions every hour. You know, that'll do it, you know, because it's a way of being. And it's saying, I don't know everything, and there's more stuff out there. And, of course, if we're asking each other, we'll get other people's perspectives, et cetera. But what I want to emphasize is both how healthy this can be in a more day-to-day way and how it could, in the best instance, also help us become people who are more pro-social, proactive, who are more altruistic. So like, why would this be healthy? Because, you know, what do you do in psychotherapy, which I've done as a therapist and a patient, right? You're looking beyond our conscious mind for other things. So sometimes the reaction to creativity, oh, we don't want that, it comes from outside and from others who want to shut us down. And we don't have time, but that can even happen unconsciously where there are biases that people exercise and they don't even know it to shut out a new voice. Okay. But we can do that to ourselves, and we do all the time, right? Because we don't want to know all that irrational stuff that we've hidden away or what Jung called the shadow and so on. So if we're truly committed, say, to being creative, we are committed to knowing everything about ourselves, about the world. There are people down the street who are starving or who are abusing each other, and often we pretend that's not true. We need to be aware of all of these things, and once we're aware, we may well want to do something about it. So there's plenty to be worried about, but also plenty of opportunity. But this opening up within oneself, I see as a long-term process that's really important. With the awareness, with the executive functions, to integrate it all and to do something with it. So it's a balance. Not just about openness, it's about openness and adaptive use. And this balance can be extremely healthy. It can integrate us. It can make us less anxious, less depressed, da-da-da, because less is hidden, and we're able to work with it directly. Okay, now what about becoming a better person? Like I was saying, you see the people down the street. You see what's happening in the world. We can't do everything individually ourselves, but working together, we can do a lot. And this is just a whole change of emphasis. And I guess one other thing I want to add here about, because, I mean, we, of course, want to listen to other people, but we also need to know when not to, right? So it's like, if you know the Stanford Prison Experiment, is that familiar? Where Phil Zimbardo and others at Stanford, luckily, not quite, I used to be there, not quite when I was there, but I hope I would have done okay. They took these undergraduates who had to do their psychology laboratory hours to get credit, and half of them became guards and half of them became prisoners, and they did a role-playing thing in the basement of a, you know, hall there. And what happened was really scary because some of them got terrified. The prisoners really felt they were helpless, and the guards weren't nice. Some of the guards became abusive, mocking, da-da-da. And the experiment, so to speak, had to be terminated early. And some of the people who took part even had to go for psychotherapy. What is happening here? a lot of unconscious stuff, a lot of falling into our roles, a lot of not questioning what happens in the world or in the class. How could a bad thing happen in the class?
This is a
famous one to look up. So I like to ask the question, who would be one of the first to say no? And there are a lot of answers to that from the literature on horrible things in the world, who's most apt to stand up. But certainly among them are highly creative people who are more so-called field independent, know how to think for themselves, and don't automatically accept whatever they're given. I think the message here is a powerful one. There are times, we want to listen, but we also want to know what we stand for in the most general way and how to let that ethic guide us rather than some rank, mindless conformity.
So. Thank you, Ruth. I think there's a couple of people that are waiting to ask more questions, so I'll just go to the next caller. Yumi? Yumi, are you there?
Sorry, I was muted. Okay. This is Yumi from Vancouver. And Ruth, you mentioned on your question of 16 Sugar and Heart, you talked about the people that were categorized in the having come up with an answer insightfully. Can you talk a little bit about the people who came about an answer analytically? Because I feel like I fall into that category.
Oh, sure. I don't think any of us fall into one category or the other. These are modes we all use at different times. And I might have solved that one by saying, okay, they're sweet, they're sour, they're bitter, and go through that to see if that led to any ideas. So there's nothing wrong with one strategy or another. Often we combine them. But why this was a clever experiment was they took the people who did it a particular way for a particular task and then were able to see what was going on in the brain. What I said about balance is important, that I've also done a lot of work on creativity and mental health. And there are these false stereotypes about creativity and madness. Being creative is about using our fuller potential adaptively. And so there's a balance between our opening to insight and our being able to use it. And so we're using all of these analytic and, integrative skills as well as a sudden insight. Does that help?
Sure. Is there are those the only two categories that were studied, or is there another
category? Those were the two main ones just for the purpose of this research, but you could study all kinds of categories because there are many different cognitive styles, over-inclusion, different things that relate to being creative. Mm-hmm. So this was more just to make the point the brain isn't doing the usual everyday thing, right? And I want to just add another point. There are a lot of reasons people can get a creative block, whether they're writing or whatever. But I think one might be it flips people who are in this state, which is a slow wave, more meditative state, back into a everyday, fast wave thinking of, am I doing it right, kind of thing. And so that's not just a distracting thought. That's a whole different state of consciousness.
Okay, thank you.
But there's no one good one or one bad one. We use them all.
Go to the next question. Hello,
can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Pallavi.
Hi, my name is Pallavi, and I had a question maybe for either of you. One thing I've noticed is that artists, especially sculptors or maybe even painters, when they're sculpting a figure, they tend to sculpt their own face. I've seen an artist who would make a female form and eventually realize it's her face. Then she'd make a male form and it would be her face. then she'd make a young person, it would be her face. And, you know, so one artist I know did tell me that, you know, it's the subconscious and everybody lands up making a self-portrait. And but then the other interesting thing was when I actually mentioned to this artist that, hey, it's the same person who's younger, she completely denied it and got upset, you know. So I was curious. I haven't sculpted, but I've been curious to see why we do that and is there a way to get past that? What if you really want to sculpt different people but you can't avoid it? You know, you can't help but sculpt your own face. I wanted to know if you have any thoughts on that.
Wow. Shauna, do you want to say something first?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. No, I do art, and I've done my own face. And I think it's the best, most convenient model, you know, in the mirror and everything. And do we, I mean, maybe this is a metaphor for how we often tend to think of the world in our own terms, or we're seeing things through our own eyes, and someone has to remind us they're younger, or this person's a male, not a female. So, no, that's very interesting, because, I mean, I wasn't doing it because I was so enamored of how good I looked.
No, I think people do it even if they're not using a mirror, you know, and I've seen it across the board, you know, even their own race shows up in the art. You know, a Caucasian person sculpts a Caucasian face, an African-American sculpts an African-American face, and I have a Japanese friend who lands up sculpting Japanese faces. So it feels like there's something deeper here, and my question really is, which is fine, that's who we are, but can you get past it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Who we are and can we get past it? Because when you're saying now, it sounds like you're talking more about ethnicity. And yeah, am I usually doing
it
for
the same? What I'm saying is we're sculpting ourselves, and it seems like you can't get beyond that. So if you really, unless you had a live model and you're sculpting somebody else, there's something in our brain function or creativity or subconscious or something that automatically makes us sculpt ourselves. We can't help it. It's probably not conscious. And that's I'm still trying to figure that one out.
Yeah, I like that unconscious. I don't know if this helps, but one thing I've had students do in a class is 1 or 2 minute drawings of each other. And I'll have the other person get in a pose. And if you're doing just 1 or 2 minutes, you don't have time to really think about it. So it's more like how in a few kind of strokes of a pencil or a brush can you capture that person. And what my intent is there is they're going to really empathize with that person. They're going to feel the way that person's standing. And, you know, so the idea is to get beyond that. And whether or not they actually do, as far as the face, I don't know, because they don't usually have time for that.
Okay.
But I agree, this is a very important question.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it makes me wonder, one, about, you know, the notion of depth versus breadth, that there may be something that it stays fascinating, and perhaps it is unconscious or subconscious, that keeps creators working on something far longer than other people would be interested in. You know, Monet painted pictures of, you know, ponds and lilies and churches over and over and over and over and over again. So this notion of depth, and then following up on what Ruth was saying is sometimes if it truly is that somebody is stuck and is just repeating, you know, has anchored on something for some reason, often trying to help them get off it is very difficult versus just taking them step by step. So they change one thing, change the color, change the direction of the line, change this, use two fewer lines until they go 25 steps and they are off of it. Mm. And then in some ways you don't want to have them notice that they're off of whatever they were stuck on because you're re-anchoring them. So there's a well-known psychological, it's kind of a cognitive error or a bias where it's very easy to anchor yourself or anchor somebody else on something, and this is why athletes need to really focus on picturing themselves playing their game very, very well or if you're going to make a sales presentation, that you have the image of presenting well. Because if you get the other image in your mind, even if you can get the image out of your mind, you have that kind of negative feeling. And so you really always want to anchor yourself on something that will help you. But it may be that their fascination with a face or their own face might be they're working through something that from the outside, we not necessarily working through as in therapy, but there's something, some fascination there for them in form or line or work. We may not know what is the dimension of the art or the dimension of their face that they're trying to explore. And there may be possibilities there that we're just not aware of.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's an artist, and she builds in a second image into every piece of art. So maybe it looks at first like it's a painting of women in pencil skirts walking away, but if you look between the pencil skirts, there's actually another picture there.
Wow.
And it's fascinating, you know.
Wow, that's great. I'm actually reminded of Shauna's teaching, as I understand it. I would love to come to one of the classes because I hear you just pushing people not just beyond who they are, but beyond what the world is. And I'm wondering how uncomfortable students are with that.
Well, sometimes they are, but it's a step at a time. And so I have to stay in the present moment all the time. And I'm often somebody that does something silly or humorous because laughter can release a little bit of tension, and then we can talk about something. I'm usually upfront about collie wobbles, and there might be times when you're frustrated, and there might be times when you're confused, and that's okay because frustration means that there's this expectation or goal that you have that you feel is thwarted in some way. And so, one, it can help you rethink the goal. It makes the goal more visible to you again. And two, it helps you realize that, okay, maybe I need to take another pathway. So frustration can be very powerful for generating creativity. Confusion is the same way. Confusion, instead of going, oh, confusion is bad, I don't know something. Yes. Confusion means that, yes, you don't know something. So you have stepped outside of your comfort zone, if you want to use the cliche term, and that's good for creativity. So recognizing these emotions for what they are and the types of information that they can give us, instead of going to kind of the cultural norm of avoid frustration, that means you're dumb, or avoid confusion, that means you don't know something. No, that's great. That's, you know, that's at the edge of culture. That's the edge of you, and that's at the edge of culture. So that's how we move forward. And so, no, I don't push them into frustration, and I talk a lot about there shouldn't be distress. And they do it. They actually have a lot of fun. And then once they have the product at the end that they've done, they're quite proud that, you know, they have something to show for the work that they've done in the class. And some of these cases that they're writing are going to be published so other people can see and maybe have an opportunity to look at things that way.
Hi, this is Elisa in Seattle. And thank you so much. Both of you are fascinating. And in some ways, my question may have been answered a little bit, but I'm not sure. I listening to you and thinking about, wow, okay, because I've always been kind of creative. I mean, I look at things, and I think almost circularly, where you're listening, you're observing, you take in new, like I take in new things, and then I'm always aware that, okay, what is it that I'm not seeing or feeling? And so kind of that, if I'm trying to solve a problem, trying different things, but then kind of stepping back and forth going, what else could I do? So I love doing that, and that's my process. And what is fascinating, because you're always, I think people, I agree with you, I'm way more creative than they know. Anytime you're trying to come up with an idea or solve a problem, you're being creative. Mm-hmm. And yet in my life, I've been stuck with this one problem for years. It's kind of like what I'm doing is gotten more and more traditional, my field, and trying to change it. And so it's interesting listening to you more and more as I was waiting in the queue going, okay, well, it's really difficult because I'm stuck in this one area. No matter what I do, I feel stuck. And I can't seem to get some of that creativity in the stuck place, whereas the way I look at things and I love the world is constantly, I have that ability. Does that make sense at all, or am I being confusing?
I hear you with a lot of potential in a context that has a lot of constraints.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, without talking to you about the exact what's going on there, because you must like the field. You've been in it for years. And, you know, if there is a way you can, you know, set some intentions for making some change within that system and maybe keep a journal and write down some ideas, think of who you could talk to. So starting with yourself and then kind of widening it a little and seeing what might be possible. I don't know. I don't have the, you know, I don't know the exact details, but it sounds like you have a lot of potential there to open up something.
Yeah, I think what's difficult is when you're inventing something, there's not a roadmap before you.
Yeah,
exactly. You're building it.
Yeah, and so it's like, when you, that's part of the problem is wanting to collaborate with other people, and they're not there. They're more in tradition. It's very hard. It's like when you're doing art, say, for example, different people are doing art. They can collaborate in doing art. But if you're inventing something new, people want to kind of go back into the box or put you back into the box. Are you aware of that in the creative process? I mean, So it's difficult. That inventive or creating something new, which is what I think in some ways service-based, this whole thing is about. I mean, that's why I participate in these calls, is because it is about, we don't even know, but it's about creating something better because there's such a anchored mindset in the way things are.
Right.
So, yeah.
Here's a kind of a counterexample, and it's in Shauna's edited book in my chapter, which is The Creative Alchemy. I am just really taken by something called Theory U in organizations. And what it's really about, because you don't only find it there, is not how we're going to change the future, but letting the future call to us. That things have an emergent power.
Yes.
It can happen in more than one way. But how do we all get together to tap into that? It's sort of a Taoist view, too. So that in this particular book called Theory U by Sharma at MIT, the organizational pattern includes different stages. And he talks about organizations not there at all and not quite there, but there involves even parts of places where you would, in effect, meditate together to get a sense of the greater vision from the future that, in the best way, could be calling us forward.
Yeah.
And he calls this the most important thing he could be doing.
Okay.
So that doesn't mean you can get there in one jump.
No.
That's an important point. Yeah. That one jump is too high.
Yeah. No, I totally know what you're talking about, because that's the difference between forcing and actually listening and taking. Because when you talked about balance, I also talk about part of that creative process is listening into something, not just people, but what you're saying in either how people meditate or whatever, and kicking in from that invisible world, and then listening, and then going back out and coming in. So I know what you mean. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you. I was wondering if Ruth and Shauna, if you would be okay with going just a few minutes over. We have just two more questions, and I'm not sure if we'll finish by 10:30.
Sure.
Okay. Yumi had another question, and she wanted to hear both of your responses to this quote by Mark Twain. And maybe, Shauna, you could respond to it first, and then Ruth, you could also respond to it. There is no such thing as a new idea. It is impossible. We simply take a lot of old ideas and put them into a sort of mental kaleidoscope. We give them a turn, and they make new and curious combinations. We keep on turning and make and making new combinations indefinitely, but they are the same old pieces of colored glass that have been in use through all the ages.
I think it's a beautiful quote, and I think that it goes back to this notion of meanings, that meanings are infinitely malleable, and so the newness comes in the perception of what emerges from the different patterns, from the patterns and the different patterns. And so I believe that a focus on if it can't be from nothing, then it has no value, because I think that the new patterns and the, if you will, to use a metaphor, the chemical reactions of these ideas in motion are what drives us. So I think the quote is a terrific quote, and I think it's good that we can combine and recombine and break things apart and recycle and add new purposes to an idea that we've had before, or use a product in a slightly different way, or adapt a tool in one situation to a completely different tool in another situation, because it enlarges our capacity to do things and to be positive in our lives. So I think it's great.
I like that part at the end, what you said about adapting tools in completely different situations and how that can help us be more positive. That's really interesting. Ruth, did you have any reactions or thoughts on the quote?
Yeah, no, I love Mark Twain. I mean, first, I'd say three things. First, I think a new combination is new by definition. It's a new combination, right? And we keep doing those endlessly. A joke is bringing together two things that seem incompatible, and it leads to laughter and actually another state of consciousness and new insight. But two other things. Harold Morowitz wrote a book I just love that I found in the last year called Emergence of Everything. And he goes from the Big Bang to the possible futures for human consciousness, etc. In 28 examples. He's a biophysicist, and it's quite an amazing book. But he starts out saying, maybe I shouldn't say this, but, you know, he hates to contradict Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun, but there is. Things are emerging all the time, not necessarily that we did, but that we never even imagined. It might have gone from the physical world to mind, from mind to consciousness, consciousness to self-consciousness, and so on, and to creativity. Okay. So I think it's an interesting quote, but what exactly it means we have to think about. And in addition, are there underlying kind of universal truths or things that we may tap into, be they Jungian archetypes or morphic resonance or Plato's forms, or, you know, are there things like that that are universal truths that we may be able to intuit? And that might be new to us. So I'm just, you know, adding a couple of qualifications there to keep us thinking. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both. And before we end, I just had one more burning question, actually. And this is about this idea of the ethics of creativity. And Anushana, you spoke to it a little bit earlier about how it's sort of evolving, because, you know, before, ethics and creativity just didn't seem to go together. You know, you think of ethics and you think of what's moral and what's right and what's boring. And you think of creativity and you think of what's, you know, outside of the box and radical. And so how did the idea for your book emerge? And can you give maybe one or two examples from your book that sort of, if someone was learning about the ethics of creativity and what that means for the first time, how would you be able to explain it?
So the book has several chapters in it from a leading creativity researchers trying to address the crossroads of creativity and ethics because it is so new. So to bring to light our assumptions about creativity and responsibility and how to be more mindful about it. So across the chapters in the book, several of the authors used real-world creators, and when they were on the ground trying to do their work, what types of ethical dimensions were present that they either did see or did not see. For example, there is a chapter by Charlotte Dixon and Helen Haste, which was a case study of Dorothea Lange, who was a woman photographer during the Depression era, and her iconic photos of people in the middle of the Depression. And the chapter explores the many seemingly small decisions that artists and professionals make. You know, for Lange, what was included and not included in a photo is actually an ethical question. The distance or intimacy of the lens to the people being photographed, the framing and composition of the thoughts and emotions and perhaps even biases and prejudices that the photos might put forth. So there's a chapter about that. Or a couple of the chapters brought up the creation of the atomic bomb. And Vera Johnsteiner and Reuben Hirsch talk about Leo Szilard. He was a physicist that actually figured out that an atomic bomb was possible, and he was trying to solve the ethical problem of ending World War II and all of the people that were dying and suffering, and that it seemed like it was going to go on for a long time. And then once the bomb came into being, he and, for example, Hans Zeth switched very quickly to the ethical problem of making sure it did not proliferate into an arms race, or coining the term massive mutually assured destruction was a term that came up then. And so as creators, recognizing that there are ethical dimensions to what we're doing, even in fields where often we don't think there is, such as the arts. The arts are amoral. Or math. A lot of people think, well, mathematics, what does ethics have to do with mathematics? And one of the authors, Reuben Hirsch, is a mathematician, and he has written about how mathematics describes relationships among things in the world, and by better understanding these relationships, it actually creates possibilities for us to have an effect on these relationships. So math very much has ethical dimensions in thinking about the positive things that we can do with it and trying to avoid the negative potential as well. So the book is full of all kinds of cases of trying to think about when you're doing ethics or when you're doing something creative, what are the ethical dimensions, including creativity in ethics, creativity in these relationships that creativity mixes cultural ingredients and new ratios and the ways that we can affect each other. There's creativity there as well.
Well, I'm really looking forward to reading this book. Thank you for providing those examples.
Can I add?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay. Because I really want to mention, this is one that would have been in the book, but she's just finishing her doctorate, Aurora Sidney Ando. And this, the reason I want to mention this is a community of teenage girls at risk in Alaska who are developing their own values in a program that helped them visualize who they were and their roles they wanted to have in their community rather than ending up in some worse place, right? And using art, but not only, also using creative conversations and kind of co-creating a new world as a group. These kids came up with things like, you know, they want to keep people safe and strong. You know, they want to be with their family and friends. And then they would say touching things like, and families should stay together, you know. to play, to have fun, to be truthful, to be accepted for who you are and not judge each other, to listen, you know, peace, to see, these kids came up with these. No war, we want to not hurt, we don't want people hurting kids. It's like heartbreaking. And they are saying a world that I think we could all want to see. So, you know, I just wanted to acknowledge Aurora and this excellent work. And, of course, they also did art that was presented to their families in the community in kind of a ritual of where their small culture in Alaska could go. Yeah. So I think there are so many places to do work here, and that ethics are just central and natural, and they're about living better. So
yeah, and it's important to contribute, because everybody, we each have a slightly different point of view on the world, and it's the mixture of those different ways of thinking about things that really make life much richer. So, you know.
Yeah. Wow. This is such a dynamic conversation. And I'll hand it off to Devin to close the call. Not sure if it's Devin, are you there?
Yes. So thank you, Bela. Shauna and Ruth, thank you so much for the conversation. We love Mahatma Gandhi's quote, "Be the change you want to see in the world." And this is actually so insightful and so fun to have these tools of the tools and ideas that you have here. So, like, you want to make the change. How do you go about making it happen? And I'm walking away with quite a few nuggets that I'm sure I'm going to use. I'm hoping the same for all of our callers as well. And if I may ask you to email us other sources or tools or references to books that might help our callers in knowing more about it and learning more about it, we really appreciate it. And so we will send it out to all the people. So links to your books, any other examples, stories, any other online links that you might have, we would love to share that with all of our callers and all of our community as well. And so one more time, thank you so much, and how grateful we are for this call. And what we like to do is have a minute. We call it minute of gratitude. So all of our callers, let's have a minute of silence all together, holding the space.
Thank you, everyone. And one thing that we love to do at the end of these calls is for all of us to express our gratitude to our wonderful guests, to you, Ruth, and Shauna, for offering your time and, you know, your wisdom and insights and stories and being a part of the community and co-creating this conversation together. So at the count of three, if we could all express our gratitude. One, two, three.
Thank you, Shauna.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Wonderful.